Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, February 11th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, Orange County's source of talk, alternative music, and anteater sports. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, available via podcast on the Stitcher app, and more information about the show and about local literary events is available on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. You can also visit our Facebook page or our Twitter page for more information about the show, upcoming shows, or to comment on what you hear. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with New York literary agent Aaron Harris. But first up, novelist Tatiana Soli. Tatiana is a novelist and short story writer. Her best-selling debut novel, The Lotus Eaters, was winner of the James Tate Black Prize and was a New York Times Notable Book for 2010 and finalist for the LA Times Book Award, among other honors. Her second book, The Forgetting Tree, is a New York Times Notable Book for 2012. Her stories have appeared in Zizova, Boulevard, and The Sun, among other places. And her work has twice been shortlisted in the 100 Distinguished Stories in the Best American Short Stories Anthology. Her new novel, hot off the press, is The Last Good Paradise, published by St. Martin's Press. Hi there, Tatiana.
Hi, Nicole. How are you?
Doing great, and welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
And happy Pub Week. So the novel just came out yesterday, right?
It did. It did.
That's exciting.
It is. It never changes. This is exciting the third time around.
So could you start off our conversation by introducing the new book to us?
Basically, it's, a satire, a comedy of manners. It's about this couple who lives in Los Angeles and has, you know, this power careers, both of them, and their life is just very stressful, and then it kind of implodes, and instead of staying and working through, they run away from home, and they run to a South Pacific island. So that's the setup premise for it.
Now, a large portion of the novel takes place on that South Pacific island.
Mm-hmm.
And you do such a nice job of painting this lush setting. Can you talk some more about creating that setting for the novel?
You know, I'm a big person. When I talk to my students, I always think that you have to plant a story. And so for me, the first thing usually that I come up with when I come up with a new book is the setting. And the island, of course, I have the fantasy, like a lot of us do, that they want to go live forever on one of these islands. But for Anne, the main character, this has kind of become the solution to all her problems. So she thinks just by physically being there, you know, her life will be transformed. So I think, in a way, it's a location, but it also is this an idea, this longing for what she wants. And so when she gets there, of course, it's nothing like what you imagine. And she meets the other characters there, and you know, life goes on and has the same ups and downs as where you came from. You just have better weather and pretty water and stuff like that.
And speaking of how you imagine it, so I was really struck when I heard you talk about the Lotus Eaters, that you had never been to Vietnam and it only went there after you turned in your manuscript. Do I remember that part correctly?
Yes, it's true.
And so how about French Polynesia? Did you travel there, or have you been there, or did you have the same method for writing about that?
You know, I actually haven't been to French Polynesia, but I've been to other islands. I've been to Fiji, and I've been to Hawaii many times and everything. So basically, no, I haven't been exactly to that atoll, but, you know, I read a lot about it. And, you know, an island is kind of they're the same except for the culture. But I've been fascinated by the Polynesian culture for a long time, and a lot of them have the same basic things. And so I wasn't specifically on that island, and that island is made up, obviously. So
I'm talking to Tatiana Soli. Her brand new novel is The Last Good Paradise. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And let's talk about food for just a moment,
mm-hmm.
because one of your lead characters is a chef.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it makes sense that the food descriptions would make the reader hungry. But what was the inspiration for Richard's career?
You always end up writing about what you're obsessed with, and all of my books end up having a lot of food in them. I think it's a fun thing to write about, and it's also something very very physical and very visceral. I mean, like when you're going to another culture, whether it's, you know, even in Vietnam, I did a lot of research about, you know, what you would be eating and the different foods and everything. And I think it's just a beautiful way to try to explore another place. For Richard, I basically, you know, I love to hang out in restaurants and talk to chefs and everything. I think it's a fascinating life. I think a lot of people, you know, when you look at the Anthony Bourdain show, we all kind of have this passion for it. And so it was fun to just spend a lot of time and spend it with him and have him be in that life. And then he also has, you know, a little a problem with preparing meat. So that kind of made it fun because he's working through his own problems as much as Anne is.
And I think you can tell that you're having fun with it, because there was one part where you just describe a meal and it was making me hungry. But then I realized that supplies were running low and he was making do with what was around. But his art helped him make the most. Now would be a good time for you to read a portion from your novel. Would you do that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This is a portion from the beginning of the book, so it's self-explanatory. But Anne has just heard some bad news, and she's kind of having a meltdown, and this kind of is the fuel for why she takes off.
Okay,
let me get started. Outside the senior partner's heavy closed mahogany door with its raised gold lettering that spelled out his name, Anne stood, realizing with a sense of premonition that she would never be behind such a door with letters spelling out her name, that the plush gray Berber carpet, the paneled walls, the tastefully spotlit artwork that had given her such a sense of permanence and security working there were not actually there for her at all. They were there to instill awe and respect among clients who were billed astronomically by the hour as they sat on those deep, ergonomically designed sofas in the waiting room, or enjoyed the espresso pod coffee brought over by the discreetly sexy receptionist. The intention of the furniture, the offices, the fine accoutrements of lawyering was to lull, to make believe that the law had some weight to it, that the clients weren't at the mercy of chance, that their fates weren't left to the vagaries of interpretation. These partners who were so tastefully and expensively dressed, whose whole presentation shouted success, were not saviors or even guides of the legal system. They were enablers. Like in Las Vegas, the house always won, and the Flask, Gardner, Bulkington, Bartleby, and Pellig partners, mostly male, quickly walking, making adjustments mid-stride to go around the marooned and stationary Anne in the hallway, were sharks who kept moving, kept litigating, or died. Anne had made a terrible, terrible mistake, thinking herself a shark, spending all those years in law school, honing a bloodlust that she had no appetite for. Now, after a decade practicing law, she had to admit that she didn't understand the first thing about the law, that it was beyond right or wrong or justice. It was about hours billed and petty vendettas, and the lawyers were paid mercenaries sent out to do unfair battle. The last time Anne felt she had truly ministered justice was as a 5-year-old, when she presided as judge over a friend who had stolen her toy. Guilty, she had pronounced, but still innocent. Anne hadn't gotten any smarter since. Drifts of briefs like snowfall blanketed her desk, covered and muffled every good intention. She could not bear the thought of growing old inside these walls. She had worked there 10 years and did not have a single person whom she could truly call friend, if friend meant someone she could tell of her unhappiness in being there. The embarrassing truth was that she wanted to be loved, and people hardly ever loved or even liked their attorneys. They were a necessary evil, like dentists or hookers.
Thank you.
Okay.
That was Tatiana Soli reading from her new novel, The Last Good Paradise. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Now, we see from that Anne is the protagonist, but you use multiple point of view in this book. And so I was trying to recall how you would use point of view in your other books. Is this the first time or was it not?
I had smaller casts of people in my previous books. I kind of wanted this to be more of a big group. I like books that have a lot of different characters, and I actually just kind of was having fun exploring all these different type of personalities, and so it evolved naturally to bounce around between them.
And there is a large cast of characters. In terms of developing the story, did you outline, or how did you keep them in check?
The funny thing is, when I was doing my MFA, this started out as a long short story, and it was kind of serious. And I had these characters there, but only Anne and Richard and Laurent were actually developed. The rest of them were kind of in the background. And so as I developed it, the story became much more, it became a totally different thing. It became comedic, and the characters, Dex and Wendy and TT had cooked, they all developed where they were not developed at all at the short story. So it just was a natural kind of growth, and it felt right for this story. I always do end up playing around with point of view a lot in stories, but this seemed wrong to stick it in Anne's mind the whole time from her point of view looking at the other characters. I really wanted to go back and forth.
And that's so interesting that it started off as a short story. Did it come back to you when you were deciding you wanted to write a new novel, or were you going back through old stories, or how did you decide to revisit it?
Actually, my agent had read it, and he liked it, but he said, you know, it didn't seem that I had explored everything. It was already 40 pages of short story, which is impossible to publish, and he said, you know, that seems to have more there than you know, you've written so far. And I didn't give it much thought, but, you know, I think I was actually touring with my second book, and I just didn't have anything to work on, which makes me panicked. And so I just kind of was playing around in my mind with the thought of expanding it. And I didn't want to expand what I had already had, but when I changed it into it's basically an entirely different story, but just using that setup, then it took off for me.
That's so interesting. What role nowadays do short stories play for you? Do you still write them?
You know, I haven't in a couple of years, and it makes me sad because I love the form, and that's what I started, you know, the first 10 years when I was writing, that's what I wrote exclusively. But as far as being a reader, I love novels, and I just have kind of trying to solve. To me, it's a form that's just endlessly challenging. I mean, every single story ends up being a totally different structure within the novel. And, of course, that's true of short stories also. But for me, it just takes so long to write one of these things that I haven't had time. But I'd like to take a break and at least have some fun and write a couple new short stories.
That's funny. Yeah, Danny Shapiro has said of short stories that they help cleanse the palate between bigger projects.
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah, because you're so stuck in one story for, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years. It's nice to go to do something that you know you're not going to, you know, put that time commitment into.
I'm talking to Tatiana Soli. Her new novel is The Last Good Paradise. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Let's talk a little bit about revision. So I'm curious about your revision process. Do you have a critique partner, or what does it look like for you?
I usually end up having, it depends, you know, my stories have been very different from each other, so I usually don't have the same person reading them the first time. So usually if I have somebody who knows a specific subject that I'm writing about, I'll have, you know, a friend or a colleague look over it. But my first, I worry about bothering my family because, you know, when a writer gives the manuscript over to your husband or your wife, or they know that you're just sitting there looking at their face for expression, and they have this pressure to love it. So I don't like to put that pressure on them. So usually when I feel really that a manuscript is ready to be looked at, I send it to my agent first. And, you know, depending on those comments, I'll take it back and revise. And then I'll start giving it to people around me when I know it's reached a certain stage that it's probably going to be published.
So may I ask you about your agent? Is this the same agent you've had since the first book?
I've actually switched for the third book. So, you know, different people involved. But usually, you know, it's I think what they're looking at is you are writing something from that's very personal and everything, and what they're looking at is, you know, is it going to find its audience, and you know, what ways, you know, have you been blind to, you know, developing it. So they get it to a stage where then you have you send it to the editor, and of course the editor is, I would think the relationship you work with your editor at a house is more like if you've been to an MFA program where your teacher actually goes, you know, to the line edits and edits to that minute degree.
And I'd like to talk some more about the theme of the book, and you've mentioned that, but it's this paradox of modern life, so being virtually connected but personally disconnected. And can you talk some more about that theme and developing it?
I'm a very technologically challenged person. When I'm working, I have a really hard time. I know a lot of my friends are on Facebook and Twitter, and they'll say, like, what happened to you? We haven't heard from you in half a year. And I can very easily just disconnect myself. But when I'm not working on a novel, or when I don't have a straining work schedule, I can literally spend the whole day, you know, connected online. And so I'm thinking, you know, with my age, I came from, you know, pre-internet, and life is just totally different. You called up people and you went out and saw people. And I think, you know, now we've all become so dependent on, I mean, my favorite thing is going out to dinner, and you'll have a big table of people, and everybody will be on their iPhone and looking at their screens, and they don't talk to each other. And it's such a phenomenon, and it's very hard to disconnect, because you almost feel like now you are being unsocial by not, you know, being online all the time. And it's just an interesting paradox, and I don't know if there's going to be a backlash eventually, and people are going to want to, you know, leave their phones at home and go out into the world. And so I liked playing with that in the book.
And are you, as an author, under any pressure from your publisher or agent to be more active in social media and that kind of connection?
I mean, of course they like it, because they like you to be out in the world, and I think some people are just naturally have that kind of energy. I enjoy it. Like, you know, at this stage when the book has come out, it's fun to go out and to be on different blogs and to talk to readers and all that. That I enjoy that process. But when I'm working, I simply don't have the mental energy kind of to do both. I think, you know, every author has to decide, you know, the time allocation. We're all struggling for time, especially if you're doing teaching or something. You just literally don't have hours in a day. And so it's the parceling them out. And sometimes I think if you do the media really well, you don't have any time left for the writing. And I've heard a lot of authors, you know, kind of talk about, like, oh, I just spent the whole, I blew the whole morning, you know, on the internet. And it's a temptation, because it's always much more easy and fun than you know, sitting on the computer and writing.
And I wonder too about the backlash coming. I sort of sense we.
I think we're all, you know, just kind of exhausted by it. There is so much to read. There's so many, and most of it's really good to read. But you can literally spend every day long just reading.
When you're writing and you're absorbed in your novel, do you have rituals that you follow? Are there any?
I do. I'm very unbelievably boring. I do the exact same routine all the time, and I think it's because you're kind of nervous about writing, and you kind of dread it. You know, there's just a little bit of tension, and so you think if you do everything right, I think it's more getting into the right mood so that you can, you know, if I have 4 good hours of where I'm really concentrated, I felt that, you know, I did a good job for that day. And so getting to those 4 hours, sometimes it doesn't come. So every morning I do a hike up in the hills and, you know, physically try to get a little bit first awake and then a little bit tired, so that I'm willing to, you know, be planted stationary for a lot of hours. And I am very, like I said, I'm not technologies. So I handwrite out, so everyone thinks that's very, it's a total, so slow. It's the slowest way that you could write, but I tend to turn my internet connection off, and I don't have phones in my office, and I try to just shut out everything. I wish I wasn't like that, but it's kind of the only way I can concentrate. So while I'm in the middle of doing a draft or something, I'm very boring.
That's interesting that you write by hand, though. We hear that less and less on the show.
I know.
But do you revise then by typing it into the computer? Is that like the first revision step?
Yeah, the first revision is typing it into the computer, and then I print it out, and then I will mark, read it and work on the manuscript on the paper, and that works the best for me. I'm not used to. I end up revising just as I enter each correction into the computer, and so I think that's also a good kind of a sneaky way for people to get more drafts in, to actually not get tired of working on one book, because it looks different on the computer screen than it does on the paper, as it does in longhand, and I think that's a good way to kind of trick yourself to be looking at the manuscript in different ways.
I like that. Let's talk about endings, because endings are hard. Do you have any philosophical comments about writing endings, or how did you find your ending for this book?
I was really pleased by this ending, because you kind of give yourself little technical challenges, and I wanted this to be a happy ending. Not totally sugary, but I wanted it to be a well-earned, happy ending. And so I'm pleased how it turned out. And I always say, to my students is when you, for me, the beginning is the hardest, because you're setting it up and then you're making all these choices. It's almost like a domino game. And if you set up the choices from the beginning to the end is inevitable. And I find usually like when I'm working with students and the ending goes flat, it's because they've lost their way in the middle. And so usually you have to go back and rebuild. And I think that's why novels are so hard and they take so long, because if you make a mistake, you're going back hundreds of pages to correct that. But if you've built it's almost like building a house. If you've built it correctly, by the time you get to the end, you will feel that it works, I think. It's not something, in other words, that you pin on at the end. It just is a natural growth, I think.
I'm talking to Tatiana Soli. Her brand new novel is The Last Good Paradise. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Tatiana, we're drawing down on our time, but I would like to, for this last question, build on what you were just talking about. So I love what you said. And for the listeners struggling with those first novels and maybe having confidence issues or just trying to get it out there, do you have any additional comments about how to plug through?
I think, maybe if you're specifically looking at the novel, it becomes such a huge thing in your head and it becomes very intimidating. And so then for myself, you have the procrastination, you keep on putting it off. Or I do a lot of novels that require research, and so I will do the endless research, much more than I need to, because I'm scared to plunge in. And so I think, honestly, it sounds basic, but it really works, is to chop up the project into very, very small steps, and then you have a feeling of progress week by week, because it's, going to probably, I'm a slow writer, but it takes usually a year to get a rough draft done. And so, when you're looking at that time frame, at the end of the year, you think, how can I get that much done? But if you, do a chapter or a page count every single week, you get there and it becomes manageable. And I think after that amount of time, you're really proud when you look back at what you accomplished. Sometimes we think we're just going to sit down and have a burst of inspiration and, write a masterpiece in a couple weeks or a month. And it doesn't work that way, unfortunately. I wish it did.
Well, Tatiana, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
That was Tatiana Soli, author of the new novel, The Last Good Paradise, published by St. Martin's Press. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with us. Literary agent Aaron Harris will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org.
This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast, and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with novelist Tatiana Soli. Next up, I'll be speaking with New York literary agent Erin Harris. Erin represents literary fiction, book club fiction, women's fiction, YA, and select narrative nonfiction. Some of her clients include Daniel Levine, Jennifer Lamb, Carla Power, and David Yezzi. Her publishing career began in 2007 when she interned for the literary agent William Clark of W.M. Clark Associates. In 2008, she joined the Irene Skolnick Literary Agency, representing her own projects and selling subsidiary rights on behalf of the agency. Erin holds an MFA in creative writing from the New School. She's a member of Pan American Center and Women's Media Group, as well as a founder and host of the Hip Lit Reading Series. She's an agent with Folio Literary Management in New York City, and I am so happy to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Erin.
Hi, Nicole. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, let's start by having you talk about what you are and what you aren't looking for a little bit more in terms of genres for your list.
Sure. In brief, I'm always looking for fabulous writing that leaps off the page, a sentence that demands to be read out loud, and a story that gets under my skin I can't stop thinking about. So fabulous writing and a really terrific premise that I can pitch and sum up in 1 to 2 distinct sentences.
And one of the areas that you mentioned on your bio that you're looking for is this term called book club fiction. Could you define that? That's always a little hard to understand, I think, for writers.
So book club fiction, I think most commonly it's thought of as a book that you would want to read with a group of people and to discuss afterward. Another way to think about book club fiction is that it's fiction that feels very accessible, that pays equal attention to both plot and to language on the sentence level. It's something that will appeal to a broad readership. It sits in that sweet spot between literary and commercial.
And as I mentioned in the intro, you have an MFA.
Mm-hmm, I do, from the New School.
And that's relatively rare, right, for an agent to have an MFA?
It's certainly not unheard of, but it is not ubiquitous. I do think that it sets me apart in some way, and it absolutely informs all aspects of my agenting practice.
Can you talk some more about that? Like, what specifically, how it serves you having the MFA for your clients?
Well, when I began agenting, I saw that there was a subtle shift in the industry. Editors are an incredible group of highly intelligent people, and they do edit. I think there's this common misconception that editors no longer edit, and that is absolutely not true. They're always digging in and getting ink on their hands. But I saw this subtle shift that agents were needing to edit their clients more frequently than in the past, particularly when launching a debut author. And I felt as though, having a background in English literature, that I had many innate skills in this area, but I really wanted to hone them and also to further understand the writer's psychology. And so I decided that I would apply to various MFA programs in New York and continue working simultaneously. And I was fortunate to be awarded a scholarship to the New School, and the classes were at night, and that fit with my schedule. And so I went and pursued that degree for 2 years. And it was an extraordinary and eye-opening experience. And today, when I work with writers, I'm very hands-on editorially, particularly for my fiction clients and particularly for debut authors. And I'm not afraid of doing multiple rounds of revision. I advise on everything from manuscript development to commenting on plot and character development to light line editing.
Wow.
It has also given me tremendous empathy for writers. It is a tough job, but a wonderful one.
We're talking to New York agent Erin Harris. Erin is an agent with Folio Literary Management, You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Now, there are writers' conferences going on all the time, and some of them have these pitch slams. Do you get involved in those at all?
I do. I attend several writers' conferences every year. Among them, Grub Street in Boston. They have a wonderful conference called The Muse in the Marketplace. I also have taught on the faculty of a writer's retreat in the Bahamas, which is a fantastic location, and that's called the Salt Key Writer's Retreat, and they always have wonderful faculty. The next retreat, I believe, is taking place in 2016, and listeners can find more information about it online. I do the Writer's Digest Conference, and several others. This year I'm traveling to Austin to attend a conference, and I also teach on the faculty of SCBWI. The pitch sessions, which you spoke of, are a whirlwind. We often sit for an hour at a time and speak with writers for 5 minutes, and they pitch us their books. They tell us about the premise, the genesis for the idea of their book, and we weigh in about the viability of the project in the market. We may offer some advice for how the writer could best move forward. And if the manuscript seems as though it would be a good fit for our list, we'll even request a manuscript and ask to see further pages.
So as an agent, is that a good way for you to find clients? Do you find it useful from your end?
It is absolutely useful. I find clients in a variety of ways. One is certainly at conferences. That is where I found my wonderful author, Stephanie Lyons, who has a debut YA novel in verse that's forthcoming from Flux in April called Dating Down. I also find clients through what in the industry is known as the slush pile, and those come in through Folio's website. And if you want to learn more about what I'm looking for, go to the website and go to my agent page and take a look at my bio. I also solicit writers. I read literary magazines voraciously. My secondary job at Folio, other than taking care of my own list and my authors, is to sell first serial and short stories on behalf of my clients and those of the agency. And so I'm a tremendous fan of literary magazines. And when I read a story that I absolutely love, I will talk to the editor of the magazine and ask if they would put me in touch with that writer. Or I'll do a little bit of sleuthing on the internet and see how I can get a hold of them, either via Twitter or their website or even their Facebook page sometimes. And I really think that scouting for talent is an essential part of my job and one that I really look forward to and relish. And finally, the last way that I find clients is through referrals, either writers that my clients have gone to MFA programs with or writers they've come into contact with in their travels.
Wow. Well, let's go back to a couple of those methods that you mentioned. So going all the way back to the conferences, if there's a writer out there planning to attend one of those, do you have any tips for them about how to prepare to meet with an agent?
I think it's really important to research the agents that are attending the conference to familiarize oneself with what it is that they're looking for. And if you have the opportunity to select the agent that you'll be speaking with, to really understand and who that agent is and to choose that agent carefully, because the reality is you're probably only going to get between 5 to 30 minutes of that agent's time. And so you want to put your best foot forward and make sure that you're finding the right agent for you to speak to that day so you can maximize your chances and your experience at that conference. Beyond that, I think conferences are terrific places to meet other writers who are working in your genre. I can't emphasize enough the importance of having a strong community of fellow aspiring or emerging writers to surround yourself with. Not only can it help with the emotional journey from writing to publishing, but it's tremendously important to have a critique group and to have people to share work with. When you're working on a manuscript for years, you can begin to lose objectivity. Your eyes can begin to cross. And it's wonderful to have other people in your corner whom you respect and admire, give you those fresh eyes when you feel as though you don't have them anymore. And on the back end, when you do have a book deal, that writer's group remains important because they can help with publicity and help champion your book on social media.
That's a good point. And going back to the slush pile, so if someone queries you, let's say, and they send a first chapter or 10 pages, what are you looking to see when you check out those pages?
The first page is the most important page. It is like the handshake at the outset of an interview. I want to fall in love with the voice in the very first line. I want it to feel unique and assured and engaging. And then beyond that, I want there to be a conflict. I want the story to start right away. Often, a misstep that I see is writers will say to me, well, it really gets great on page 20, or things begin to gain momentum around page 20. And my advice to them is to begin your book on page 20. You want to put your best foot forward. You want to shoot your story out of a cannon, as it were. Beyond the sample pages that I ask to accompany the query, let's talk about the query itself. In the query, I want a very succinct and to-the-point description of the project. I want to feel as though I get what the project is immediately. In some sense, I think a query should read like the jacket copy of a book, minus some of the accolades, perhaps. You don't want to say, this is the best novel you'll ever read, or my writing is luminous. You want to be objective about it and just give us the very basic facts of the story in the most straightforward manner possible. It also really helps to contextualize your work within the market. I want to know what genre the project is that you're querying me about. I want to know the word count so I can see if it's the appropriate length. And it is also often very helpful to have comparison titles, or what we call comp titles, which is a basic, this book is like X meets Y, that kind of formula. And then I want an author bio where you tell me what your credentials are. Do you have an MFA? Do you work with a writing group? Have you won any awards? How long have you been writing? And sometimes people will list awards such as the spelling bee they won in second grade. And that kind of thing isn't really helpful. So you don't need to have awards in order to query an agent. But if you have the right kind of awards, it's very important to tell us. If we do sign you, are entering into a business partnership of sorts. So we want to know that you will be someone who is receptive to feedback and will be easy to work with.
We're talking to agent Aaron Harris. Aaron is a literary agent with Folio Literary Management in New York City. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And Aaron, I'm curious what involvement you have with social media, like with Facebook and Twitter. As an agent, do you have a profile on those venues?
I do. I am on Twitter, and I tweet actively. Mainly, I use my Twitter account for promoting my authors, for sharing their work with the world, for connecting with emerging writers, for tweeting aspirational quotes, sometimes for airing certain gripes, for sharing publishing news, connecting with editors, and for talking about the interesting things I may be seeing or doing in New York City, a city I absolutely love and feel very fortunate to live in. And I'm on Facebook as well. My Facebook page is a kind of hybrid page. It is both personal and professional.
And do you think it's important for authors to have the same sort of social media presence?
Absolutely. I think it's very important for authors to promote their own work. They are their own publicity machines. Being active on social media, you can connect with your readers in a way that is very exciting, that we once weren't able to connect with our readers. You know, they're literally at your fingertips. And it's also a wonderful way to connect with other writers, which I think can yield tremendous opportunity, either for blurbs or for joint publicity events and readings, and just to have a vibrant, ongoing dialogue about literature.
And you co-curate a speaker series called Hip Lit. Could you talk about that and what its mission is and how it's organized?
Absolutely. So Hip Lit is a literary event series that's based in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are relaunching this spring at our new home, The Electric Studios, which I'm very excited about. And Hip Lit was founded 3 years ago. I started the literary event series with two of my wonderful colleagues from the New School MFA program, who also work in the publishing industry. And they are Kim Perrell, who is an agent at Wendy Sherman Associates, and Brittany Inman, who is the U.S. publicist for Pushkin Press, which is a press based in the UK. And our mission with HIP was that we wanted to reinvigorate the idea of a reading series. When we were in graduate school, we attended reading series all the time and loved it, but we always thought it was such a shame that the reading was an occasion where like-minded, intelligent, interesting people were in the same room, and yet after the reading, we found that everyone dispersed. And there really wasn't occasion for the audience to mingle and meet each other and forge lasting connections, both personal and professional. And so what we did is we basically decided to throw a party for books. Each reading features three readers at all different stages of their careers. Some are very established authors, such as Taya Obrecht, who is the author of The Tiger's Wife, or Ayad Akhtar. And some people are emerging and don't have books yet or have published with indie presses such as Dolan Morgan or Rosalie Connect. And we have these three readers read for approximately 10 minutes. And each reading is themed loosely. We've had the End of the World edition. We've had a Freedom edition. We've had a Circus edition. And the readings draw inspiration from the theme, though they're not always a literal representation of the theme, but rather they can be a loose interpretation of the theme. And then after the reading, we have a Q&A, a la the Actors Studio, where we ask three questions. And then we like to include a kind of multimedia component. For example, at our Circus edition, we had a wonderful trapeze artist called Sayana perform. We've had bands, we've shown videos, and we always hold our events on either a Friday or Saturday night. So it becomes an activity. And people stay afterward, and we have food, and there's always cocktails. And we have found that people stay, and meaningful connections have been forged at our events, which is such a tremendous joy for us.
I love that. And you are in New York City. And in terms of publishing, it has this lore. Is it still the case that New York is the place to be for writers and deal makers?
Given the way our society has changed, given how connected we are through social media and the internet, I think that one can absolutely engage with the publishing world and not live in New York. I think it's a fallacy to think that you have to be here on the ground. Many of the writers I represent, Daniel Levine, for example, the author of the New York Times Editor's Choice novel, Hyde, he lives in Colorado. And my author, Carla Power, who was a journalist for Newsweek and currently writes for Time Magazine, she has a memoir forthcoming from Holt called If the Oceans Were Ink, and she lives in the UK. So I certainly don't think that you need to live in New York to be published, nor do I think that you need to live in New York to agent. Many wonderful agents live elsewhere. But with that said, on the agenting side, I do think that you need to have very strong ties to New York. The publishing landscape is always in flux, is always changing. People, editors especially, move houses. And so it's important to be very in touch with what is happening here. As long as your agent who lives elsewhere comes to New York on business trips, I think then that is absolutely fine to have an agent who works elsewhere.
We're drawing down on our time, Erin, but before we let you go, I wanted to ask you if you have any words of advice to our writer listeners, particularly those who are at the stage of querying. You offered some earlier, but anything further to help them out with some do's and don'ts about querying?
Absolutely. I think the first rule is don't give up. If you believe in your work and you've worked very hard on your manuscript and you've done your homework, it's just a matter of time before you find the right fit. So really do your research, figure out which agent is looking for the kind of project that you're shopping, and try and find that agent. If you are not getting traction in any way, it may be because you haven't written a project that's viable in the market, and so you may want to consider what you're writing. The most important thing is the book itself. It is important to have a good query, but more important than that is the actual book. I think that you can still find an agent, even if you've made a misstep with your query, so long as the book is incredibly strong. You should be able to talk about your book in a succinct manner, in a way that feels instantly gettable and that excites people, that encourages them to want to read it.
Mm. Well, Erin, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, Nicole. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Erin Harris, a literary agent with Folio Literary Management in New York City. You can find her on Twitter, on Facebook, and at foliolit.com. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be back next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. And stay tuned for Roots and Rhythms with Sister Rue coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.